every step of the way has been reinvention. And usually it's come from me feeling like I'm stuck, like I'm banging at some door that is not opening, and me deciding, all right, well, rather than stand here and bang on this door, I'm going to open another door.
If you are a creative in the entertainment industry looking for inspiration and practical ideas about how to take the next steps in your career, you are in the right place. My name is Rebecca Doyle, and I work in film and television in Los Angeles. I learned so much from the ups and downs of the talented, innovative people surrounding me, and I want to share those insights with you. Join in every other week to hear the break-in stories of people who overcame challenges and found unconventional avenues to pursue their dream careers in an industry that has no set path. It's happened. Hollywood writers have voted to authorize a strike that may go into effect on May 1st. And today we are talking to someone who weathered the last writer strike in 2007 and is here to share real insight and advice. No sugarcoating on this issue, as well as breaking into various parts of the industry, as our guest has an extensive career as a producer, screenwriter, and author. Nina Sadowski is the author of 5 original novels published by Penguin Random House, most recently her thriller Privacy. Her books, The Burial Society and The Empty Bed, are currently in development for television. Nina served as the president of production for film financier and foreign distributor Signpost Films, where her projects included the Academy Award nominated The House of Sand and Fog. Prior to joining Signpost, she served as president of Meg Ryan's Prufrock Pictures and was the EP for the film The Wedding Planner, starring Jennifer Lopez and Matthew McConaughey. Her producing credits also include Desert Saints, starring Kiefer Sutherland, the supernatural thriller Lost Souls, starring Winona Ryder, the telefilm Northern Lights, starring Diane Keaton, and the Sundance indie feature Jumpin' at the Boneyard, starring Tim Roth, Jeffrey Wright, and Samuel L. Jackson. Nina has written screenplays, adaptations, and rewrites for companies including Starz, the Walt Disney Company, Working Title Films, and Lifetime Television. After more than a decade educating students at the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts, Nina is now the founding director for NYU Los Angeles, where she works while continuing to write her next book. Today, Nina and I are talking about navigating strikes, company shutdowns, challenging situations with balancing family and work, how to constantly reinvent yourself in this industry. And in the beginning and towards the end of this interview, we get into exactly how to navigate the pending strike. Let's get into the interview. Nina, thank you so much for joining me today on this early episode of the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Rebecca.
So I know you have so much going on right now in your own career, and you also have some valuable insight about the looming writer's strike coming up, the union strikes. But first, let's get started. What are you the most excited about that you're working on?
I suppose my new book, which is called The Ghosts of Ojai, which is my first foray into the supernatural. And I'm excited for my last book, Privacy, a psychological thriller about how we have no privacy and how that's making its way through the world. Oh, and I'm also really excited that I'm in a Tubi show called About the Author TV, and I am season 4, episode 30. I'm with just amazing literary company, a lot of people that I have, like, you know, book crushes on. So that was very exciting. That just dropped last week. That was exciting.
And your upcoming book has a release date that is not yet public. Is that correct?
Well, it's not yet known because I haven't finished it yet. And no publisher will give you a release date until you deliver a book. So, yes.
Well, I love that we're catching you.
Busy.
Yes. I love that we're catching you in the throes of creativity. And thank you again for taking the time to pause that to speak to me today. I also know you have experience from the last writer's strike and some valuable insight having gone through that and seeing some upcoming predictions. Can you speak to your experience about going through that, how you weathered it, and what your advice would be for people who are concerned about it?
Well, the 2008 strike was really hard on a lot of people. It was really hard on me personally. I was sort of I know this podcast really focuses on breaking in, and I've sort of had two distinct episodes of breaking in. So my second was as a writer, which I did in really about 2006. I had gotten a divorce. I had 2 little kids. I was a producer who didn't want to be away all the time. And so I thought, well, I've always loved writing and I've always written. And I adapted a book on spec and it got me signed by ICM. And next thing I knew, you know, in 18 months, I had, you know, I think I had sold 2 scripts and gotten 1 adaptation assignment, right? So I was doing really well. And I had also spent a lot of time adapting a book that I was going to direct. And the strike happened and everything got put on hold and that deal fell apart. And the author, who had been at the same management company as I had been, so we had all sort of a handshake deal because we were all in-house, changed representation and I lost the rights. And that's sort of a funny segue of how I got into teaching, because the other thing I do is run NYU Los Angeles, which is an entertainment program for students.
Who stole you from USC.
Correct. It's where I know you from. So USC still continues to give me good things in terms of the relationships I have. But so for me, I was just hitting my stride as a writer. I just felt like I had just begun that career. And I was already at an age where a lot of people thought writers should be aging out because there is an emphasis on youth, and even more so than I think than now. I think there's a little more respect for the fact that of all disciplines, you only get better as a writer the older you get because you have more experience, more, you know, more things to draw on. But I was already, you know, quote, old for being, a baby writer. And I don't think that my writing career didn't really recover after that. I mean, this is my personal cost of the strike. And, you know, it hit different people differently. You know, I felt, you know, I have a very good friend who's a really powerful showrunner. And, you know, I was walking with him on the Fox picket line and he said, you know, we're writers. We get told no 10 times before breakfast. You know, we have the spine to wait them out. And I was like, yeah, we do. But, you know, none of the producers are going to lose their houses or their careers. And I think that the last time the strike was used to clear a lot of development slate, to force majeure a lot of deals, overhead deals that the studios or networks no longer thought were profitable. And that is my fear for this strike as well. You know, basically a force majeure clause, which includes acts of God and strikes as a legitimate reason for canceling a deal without any further payment. That could be a big advantage to the studio. I think in the last strike, they stockpiled. They knew it was coming. They stockpiled material. I don't know if that's happening this time. It doesn't seem to be from what I see, but I'm also a little less in the fray because I sort of took myself out. Well, the shift that I had brought me back in after that period when I felt sort of marginalized by let me back up a second. So after the strike was over and there was commerce again and people could hire writers again, the world had also changed. And there used to be a system, you know, agreed upon system that was based on quotes. So if you got X dollars for your last movie, if it did well, you could get X plus Y for your next movie, right? But that was based on a quote system and a basis. And the way writers were hired was they would see who is available and then they would see what that person cost. And there was a real shift after the strike where a lot of buyers would say, this job pays X. And if various writers wanted to work and had been used to getting more than X, they would take less than X. And I talked to a lot of people, representatives and fellow writers who felt, you know, that they really got upended by this. The world changed. And so for someone like me, who was sort of a baby writer who was doing okay, but wasn't established, didn't have anything produced, I was suddenly competing for jobs with people who were far more senior than I was. So, you know, how I kind of broke back into that again was after a particularly frustrating TV pitching season where I felt sort of ill-used and, you know, led along and strung along by various people and where I was putting out a lot of work on material that I didn't own. I, you know, developed a pitch adapting a book for one producer and an original idea for another producer. And in both deals, I felt just sort of ill-used. And so I felt like I was losing my love of writing, which I didn't want to do. And so I decided I was going to write a book on spec. And it took me a year and a half. I worked only on Sundays because I had a lot of other things going on. But I finally finished a book and I didn't tell anyone even that I was working on it because I didn't want people to go, how's that book coming? And me saying, oh, yeah, well, you know. But I finally finished. And then to my utter shock, I didn't know anyone. I didn't know literary agents in New York, but I knew people who knew people. And so really to my shock, after 3 weeks of finishing the book, I had a literary agent who sold it at auction to Random House. And then which was terrifying because an auction means we're taking bids till five and then it's off the market. And I was like, what if no one bids? You know, it's terrifying. But we had the auction, Random House bought it, and they published, they've now published five of my books. So, you know, that, and then that first book I sold back to Stars and I got to write the pilot. The second two books I optioned to ITV for development. So that kind of brought, those books sort of brought me back as a force, as a writer. And that's sort of now my cottage industry. I don't really look for assignments and I don't, if I write original material, it's usually in prose first with an eye to like if it would be great if it got adapted. And I also feel, you know, more now like I'm an idea machine. And so other people can adapt, right? Like I used to always be, I wanted to be the one who always to adapt and I wanted to be the one to oversee everything. And now I'm just like, you know what? I love writing prose. There's been a lot of sales of short stories lately. It makes me think, well, maybe I should write some short stories. A hell of a lot less work than a whole book. And then maybe sell that. But, you know, I do feel like the future of the business is in transmedia IP. And so by which I mean IP that can work in multiple territories and multiple platforms. You know, the Marvel Universe is the perfect example, right? It's global. It can be comic books, graphic novels, animated, live action, you know, theme parks, toys, right? I think that's where we're going because there's so much content. It's very hard to cut through the clutter. So having something that's identifiable as part of a universe or a brand just makes selling it easier. So I think that's the trend. So I feel like I think about that with respect to an idea I have now. It's like, can it live in different formats? How would this play internationally? Could this be, you know, is there a transmedia potential in this idea?
And when you first started out with that first book, you said that with the recent books, you're definitely thinking about how this could be adapted for the screen. Mm-hmm. Was that on your mind with the first book or were you expecting it to get adapted or was this purely for the sake of pursuing your love of writing?
Well, it was really for the sake of trying to reclaim my love of writing. Although, you know, as a lawyer in recovery and someone who's been in the business a long time, I did have a little thought in the back of my head was, well, if anything happens, I own the IP.
Yeah.
Right. Because I had as I said, it'd come off experience where I developed adaptation of a book for someone else where I didn't own the IP. Situation didn't end well, but they own the underlying book and I own the pitch and neither of us could move forward without the other. And so I just thought, for a writer, that's a vulnerable place to put yourself in. So at the first one, I just thought, well, maybe, you know, if something happens, at least it'll be mine. But I didn't really expect it to sell. I was genuinely shocked when it did because for a couple of reasons. One, in addition to coming out of frustration about the business and how I felt I was being perceived and treated, it also came out of the fact that I had recently had a midlife remarriage and I had blended a family of four teenagers and then suddenly discovered that my stepson was doing everything he possibly could to destroy our marriage and was just behaving horribly. And my husband and I were really in a tough place because, you know, of course, you love your children beyond measure and you love your partner. But, you know, it was really impossible. And he and I had gone down for a getaway weekend to Laguna. And we were going to, like, you know, hang out in a nice hotel and have drinks on the beach. And, you know, we were supposed to talk about this problem. And we got down there and it was freezing cold. And even the weather didn't cooperate. Couldn't hang out at the beach. We went to the movies to get warm. We had to buy sweatshirts and we were not talking about the problem. And the when we were about to leave, I was standing out at the little terrace watching guys play football down on the beach. And I looked over and my husband was lying on the bed with his arm flung up. And for a second, I imagined him with a knife in his stomach because I was just so tense and angry and feeling like he wasn't protecting me in this situation. And so being a writer, I grabbed my notebook and I scribbled down that scene. And it is the opening of my book, Just Fall. Although it's not me. It's a woman who on the eve of her wedding discovers her husband is a contract killer. And of course, it's a metaphor for where we compromise ourselves in the name of love and how we all of us in pursuit of love paper over a lot of things that we might be red flags that we just don't want to see because they don't line up with the picture that we're creating in our head. And so it was very much about me in that sense of saying I couldn't have predicted this turn. And on the other hand, you know, obviously it's not about me at all.
So while we're talking about breaking into the novel space, do you think that your path doing that would have been different if you had started writing books earlier in your career?
That's a question I have asked myself. I mean, I will say this about my career. It has been completely unplanned and haphazard. Like, I wish I had had more direction. I knew that I loved certain things growing up, theater, dance, the arts. I have an undergraduate degree in dance with a minor in creative writing. I thought I was just a complete artist. And then my father, this is not nice to reveal about myself, but I will share this. My father bribed me to go to law school. He said he would pay for an apartment if I went to law school.
Wow.
And I was like, 20 years old. I had graduated college early. I was 20 and I was living at home with my parents again. And I was like, I'll take that deal. So I did go to law school and I felt very at odds there. It was so out of my identity, but I think for my very educated, literate children of immigrant parents for whom education was everything, I was going to get some kind of graduate degree no matter what. And I wasn't going to med school. And I wasn't going to become an accountant. So I went to law school. But then I from there, I went to work at the Schubert Organization and then Kaufman Astoria Studios. And then I basically made my first movie out of my apartment in Greenwich Village, which was how I first broke into the business.
Yeah, you posted something, right? Saying that you were looking for people to work?
Yeah, so I decided, I didn't know what I was doing. Talk about my career being haphazard. So I had a law degree. I had spent some time working, for a production facility. I just sort of hung out a shingle and decided that I was going to be a producer. I didn't really know what I was doing at all. But I thought I have artistic sensibility and I have this business side. Maybe that would be a good...
And the personality traits of a producer as well.
Compulsive workaholic? Or is that... That one? Yeah.
Taking initiative, go-getter, vision.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So I posted index cards. It was pre-internet. So I posted index cards at NYU and Columbia. I was living in New York at the time. And I just said that I was looking for scripts. And scripts started coming over the transom. And the first movie I made was one of those strips. Scripts, actually, oddly enough, from an NYU student, bringing me back full circle to working for NYU now. But that movie we got made, it was called Jumpin' at the Boneyard. It went to Sundance, which, of course, is a big golden ticket. It starred a lot of people that are... were not famous then, but are famous now, like Sam Jackson and Jeffrey Wright and Tim Roth.
So you were breaking in. I mean, this is kind of the epitome of the point of the podcast, is just blazing your own trail and forging your own path. You graduated law school and you wanted to make a movie. So you posted cards for the script. And then how did you know what to do next? How did you find the financing and get a cast? I think these are still things people are thinking about today.
Yeah. Well, again, I did not really know what I was doing, but I was smart enough to hire smart people, right? And to ask smart people, right? So I had been working with the director, writer-director on the script, and then he won a film competition that the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor had, and it turned out that Larry Kasdan was had sponsored that. And so he agreed to lend his name, which was a big name. And so that helped us get the cast.
Mm.
And then that helped us get the financing. And then we made a movie for, under $1 million in New York City, which, really town and dirty. And then we screened it for Fox. And I think that this was pre-Fox Searchlight. This is how dated I am, but it was pre-Fox Searchlight. So they didn't even really have an indie division yet. And I think they were just astonished that we had even gotten something on celluloid for how little money they had given us. Cause they're used to making, multi $100 million movies. But then we got into Sundance and, launched some careers, including our own. So that was, but I will say this, I have not known what I was doing so much of my career. I've so many times have had ambition or vision or an instinct and have just said, all right, I'll take a shot at that, and learned so much, made so many mistakes, been willing to be humbled and happily humbled, honestly, because that's really how you learn. I feel like that continues to this day. I'm still learning and still reinventing, what I want to do next. And, it's interesting because relative to the subject of this, I broke in sort of as a producer. I think that was one phase when I was an indie producer in New York. Then I kind of broke into Hollywood when I partnered with Meg Ryan, which I did for 5.5, 6 years. And
as the president of production of her company.
Yeah, as president of production and made big movies like The Wedding Planner with Jennifer Lopez and Matthew McConaughey and Northern Lights with Diane Keaton and Lost Souls with Winona Ryder, right? So I was working with big stars and operating on this very high Hollywood level. And then from there, I went to run an international co-finance and distribution company called Signpost. And the first week on the job, I bought the House of Sand and Fog with Jennifer Connelly and Ben Kingsley. And so that, you know, so there was like, I had this very, very heady Hollywood, what I call like high Hollywood part of my life, where I was finding myself suddenly at, you know, intimate dinner parties with Tom Hanks or hobnobbing on a very, very high level, you know, at Carrie Fisher's house for dinner, looking around myself on, you know, behind myself at the fried chicken line and, you know, finding George Lucas.
What were those moments like?
I mean, I'd be honest that I was more starstruck by directors and actors,
totally.
Right?
Yeah.
So like there were directors I had crushes on that I was just excited to talk to. Like George Lucas, that was a thrill meeting him. You know, I did ask if he'd like to go ahead of me in the fried chicken line. He was a gentleman. I loved working with Carrie Fisher, who was really kooky, but was really delightful. Sometimes it felt really surreal. You know, like when Diane Keaton came to my Seder for 3 years running, because we made a movie together. Our daughters were both one. And so we hung out all the time because we were on location in Vancouver with one-year-olds. And so she came to my Seder that year and then enjoyed it. You know, like having Annie Hall at your Seder. I mean, some of those things are surreal.
Yeah.
So I had a really fun, that was a really, I think, a fun, productive time. But the company that I ran, Signpost, which was an international co-finance and distribution company, not through any fault of mine, but through my bosses, lost its funding. And so 6 months in, I was settled out, and which meant I was 6 months into a 2-year contract and I got most of that money in a lump sum, which a lot of people think, oh my God, I would love that, you know, get a big lump sum and reinvent your life. But this is really when I started writing. I was miserable. I felt like I had poured my life's blood first into Meg's company and building that. And we had a really successful company, which she decided to end because she, you know, had an affair and didn't want to be with Russell Crowe and her marriage was falling apart. She didn't want to be that public anymore. So she decided to dissolve a company. And from there, I had gone into Signpost. And then my boss owned it. He said I should have been concentrating on raising more money instead of, you know, building the business. And so I came out of that going, oh, you know what? I don't want to put my faith in someone else again. I've been slaving. I slaved to build a company for Meg and I slaved to build a company for Stuart. And what was I left? You know, so when I got settled out, you know, I had the total loss of identity. I had some money in the bank, but I had a total loss of my identity. And that's where a lot of things happened. My first marriage broke up. Yeah. So my marriage was falling apart. I realized that I didn't want to be away from my kids that much. And so that's when I switched to writing, because I had that settlement. I was able to take a few months, adapt that first book, which was a melodramatic, historical, great book called Indiana Gothic, about the first use of the temporary insanity defense in an American murder trial.
Oh my gosh. Wow, I can see stylistically what's been consistent through your career.
Yeah, yeah. It was just a great book. And that really kind of, and so I took the time then. I did two things. I took the time to adapt that book and I took some of the settlement money and I wrote and directed a short film.
The First Year's a Bitch.
First Year's a Bitch, yes.
That's the name of the film.
Yes, no, that was the name of the short film. It's called The First Year's a Bitch and it was about newlyweds. I keep coming back to that, about romantic entanglements and feeling like, you know, what did I get into and how hard it is to be. Well, I guess just a human, much less a human in relationships. But.
So, okay, two things I want to ask about the eras we've talked to up until now. So when you were figuring it out and you said, you know, you wish you'd had some more direction, if you had an ideal mentor at that early stage, what advice do you wish they would have given you?
Well, I did have some good mentors, I will say. And I do want to say that Larry Kasdan was a very generous mentor when I was starting out, very generous with introductions and advice. And I really appreciated that. I think it's less that I needed an ideal mentor, that I needed to be less afraid to ask, right? I felt, and this is partly my personality, and maybe it's part of a producer's personality, I felt it was my job to fix the problem, right? And so I was always felt sort of hardwired to figure out, I must know the answer. And I think as I've gotten older and probably better at everything I do, I've gotten more able to say, yeah, I don't know. Let me see who I can ask. I've gotten better at that. But I did have some good mentors and a lot of people that I just felt were like peer mentors in a way, you know, people that I came up with that I felt, you know, we really supported each other and supported my belief that career building is community building. Because you want to, if you're making art, you want to not only share like a creative aesthetic and a work ethic, but I think it's very important to have value alignment because,
yeah,
you know, when you're working, you know, the way you can in film 100 hours a week, you know, if you're working with people who make your skin crawl because they don't, you know, they're hateful or, you know, just not, don't share your perspective on the world, then, you know, it makes it all the harder. And the work is hard enough without that. So
definitely. Okay. So definitely not to the detriment of the existing mentors, but if there's one piece of advice that you wish someone could have given you or maybe a mistake you could have prevented, would there be anything?
Yes. I wish someone had told me not to take things that didn't work so personally. Right? Like I had a movie that I sold in a big multi-studio auction that when it was released didn't actually perform well in the box office. And, you know, a lot of people worked on that. And honestly, at the end of the day, the director, right, that owns the film, but that I really personalized. And also when Signpost collapsed, I really took it, even though I had nothing to do with it, I felt sort of a sense of shame about it.
Yeah.
That I didn't, I took me a long time to say, I did not own that shame. I shouldn't have, you know, I was a representative for that company. I was not that company. So, and I was someone who worked on that film, but I am not that film. So I think that's what I wish someone had said to me, you know, you're inevitably going to have failures. Don't take them so much to heart.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that you were on location for a project with a 1-year-old. I mean, Nina, you just did it all so much earlier because these are still problems that I think a lot of parents and particularly women are facing today where there's kind of this false dichotomy where you feel like you have to choose either being present for your kids or present for your work. And so many women are full of passion for both. What was that like?
I will say that it was not easy always. When I was on location with a 1-year-old, my then husband was writing, so he was able to travel. And so, and I think we hired a friend of the family to come live with us who was between jobs to kind of like hang out, you know, it's like two men and a baby. And I'd be on set and the three of them hung out and like saw Vancouver. So it was hard. I remember my son got really mad at me when he was little and I was working a lot of hours and stopped letting me put him to sleep at night, like just rejected me. And that was really hard. And I had to take him. I took him to, he must have been only like, I don't know, 3, 4. And I took him to breakfast and I said, you know, if we friends again, he was like, all right, now you can put me to bed. Like he, you know, he was mad. And I did always feel like I was missing something, right? Like either I wasn't giving my kids full time or I wasn't giving my job full thing. But, you know, I look back at some, I have pictures of me like breastfeeding with a phone and a script. When Meg offered me the partnership, I was 8 months pregnant and I thought I had, which was astonishing on her part that she offered a job to someone that pregnant. But I thought I had a month before the baby would come and then I had planned to take leave, you know, and then I was going to start. And instead I had an emergency C-section the same week as the job offer. She and I both nearly died. And then I came home and went right to work, probably because I didn't want to deal with that fear. So I just said, yeah, sure, start sending scripts.
Oh,
so that
my
was
gosh.
Wacky. Yeah, so that was hard. And then, you know, she was premature. She was tiny. But I went to work pretty soon after she was born. And my then husband stayed home and was like a stay-at-home dad for a year. That was the deal we made. But, you know, that doesn't always work. I had a lot of nannies roll through, some good, some terrible. I always felt this. I always felt I have my parents both worked, and not just worked, had careers. My mother was a writer and an editor, and my dad was a politician and a lawyer. You know, they were very much about having a life of the mind. They were also very much about doing good in the world and activism and caring about things and speaking up about that. And so I thought, well, that's what I want to model for my kids. And I didn't want them to see, no denigration to people who choose to stay home, but that's not who I was. And I knew that I would be unhappy. And the same way I knew that I should not model what I had with my first husband as a marriage for them, because we weren't happy, right? My elder child very recently told me that she interrogated both her dad and I, and now understands much more about our respective perspectives, and that also recognizes we shouldn't be together. That was very mature, I thought. But obviously you have conflict. You can't, I do say you can do it all, you just can't do it all at the same time. And I think for a lot of women, I had some moments of regret that I wasn't more present, but I also was the sort of mom who couldn't wait till I could just say, go take a shower, because the routine of bath time every night for years, you know, begins to wear thin. Like, you know, I'm not going to lie about that. When I could say, go take a shower, did you brush your teeth, instead of having to supervise everything, it was a gift, you know. And, you know, I really enjoy my, you know, young adult children now, so as who they are as people, and they're both creative and they're both entrepreneurial, and I like to think that they got a lot of that from me.
Yeah. I think something a lot of creatives struggle with is a fear about being honest in their work. And what I mean by that is, you know, you've even told very specific stories about how things going on in your personal life with your marriage at the time inspired scenes in your books. Mm-hmm. And I hear from a lot of my peers, they're hesitant to do that because they're just afraid of putting their personal life into their work. How have you addressed that fear? Was it just never even a consideration for you?
Well, I mean, for me, writing and creating is how I process, right? So if I mean, the topics I've dealt with in my books, which are everything from human trafficking to domestic violence to mental illness to how we have no privacy to the damage pathological lying does, right? Like, these are things that I've been wrestling with, right? And that I look at society and I see society is wrestling with. And for me, writing comes very much a way about synthesizing that. I write about myself all the time, although it's not really myself, right? It's, you know, it's a version, it's inspired by. I think a writer's job is to be authentic. You know, people say write what you know, which I think is terrible advice, because if I just wrote about middle-aged white ladies, I mean, that would be, I don't know, seems limiting, right? So I feel like I want to write about a lot of things and a lot of different people. And I feel, and so I sort of proceed from this perspective. I believe that on a base level, we are more alike than we are different. People want the same things. They want security, comfort, meaningful work, community, you know, a full belly, a roof over their heads. I don't think really much more than that. I think people really are more alike. And I think that we can figure out how to connect once we get past all the noise, right? Mm. If we can. I think there's a lot of noise right now. But I really believe that. And I hope that my work kind of moves that needle, right? I write because I want to work it out for myself, but I also hope people will read my books or watch my stuff and have a really fun time, but then also maybe think about the issues, right, that were addressed. And I think that, so for me, that's why I'm a storyteller, right? And that, for me, because of that, can't help but be personal, right? So I would say that where I'm most revealing probably about myself is in my dispatch, which is I publish usually once monthly. It's been a little short again for personal reasons this year because I had my current husband had a very serious heart situation, so I was taking care of that, not writing. But I write very openly there. I've written about losing my parents. I've written about my husband's illness. I have to caution people not to reach out to him because sometimes they do. And he's like, how does everyone know my business? I'm like, well, if you read my dispatch, then you would know your business too. But I've decided that, you know, I'm not a public figure, right? I'm like a semi-public figure, I guess. People know my books, but they, you know, it's not like...
You've also educated half the film industry at this point, but yeah.
Well, I've educated a lot of film industry. It still doesn't make me a public figure, I don't think. But I think that, but I hope that, you know, I hope if what people think of me is that, yes, that I educated, I'm really proud of that, but also that I cared a lot about a lot of things and that I tried to educate and communicate in a way that committed you know, talked about what I was committed to and showed what I hoped we could be as a society. That's really, you know, been my goal. And so that is inherently personal, right? I hope that that, so my work, and I feel like also, and this may be about getting older too, is that I feel more fearless, right? I used to have a lot of fear about how I was perceived. And can I use bad language on your podcast?
I think so, yeah.
It's like, I'm at the point where I give no more f**ks. There are no more left to give. I am myself, right? I'm very grounded in who I am. I own myself now pretty fully. And after, I think, a lot of people, and particularly women, being at war with myself for a long time. And now I'm kind of like, you know what? This is who I am. I have nobody else. I'm just going to double down on this, right? I feel proud of who I am on the main. And the things that I'm not proud of, I'm actively working on myself. And so why wouldn't I be personal about that?
Which do you think came first? Taking the leap into writing something where you were the person calling all the shots, mm-hmm. and kind of the self-confidence to stop caring. Like, did you stop caring and then you started working on something that only mattered to you? Or did you work on things that mattered to you and then gain the confidence afterwards?
That's a good question. It might have been simultaneous, right? It might have been like on, I mean, I think as an artist, well, for a long time, you know, as a producer, what I did was uplift other people's creativity, right? I think I was a little scared of shining a light on mine, because what if it was found wanting, right? So I think for a long time, and when I sold my first script, I did an interview with Variety, and they were, and the Michael Fleming, who was then the reporter there, said, you know, well, why the switch? And I said, well, you know, as a producer, I've championed a lot of first-time directors. I've discovered a lot of new writers, and I felt like it was time to discover my own voice. So I think that's what really kicked in there. And then from there, it was sort of a gradual process, I think, where I discovered more of my own voice. And the more I began to have success with that, as I sold scripts, as I sold books, as I, you know, felt more confident, then it enabled the other one. But I, you know, something else I want to talk about is some of the people that I helped along the way that I'm just so proud of, right? Because I think that one thing I'm looking at is like, where has my influence been, right? And who have I helped, and what impact have I made through that? And so here are a couple of people that I gave their first jobs to that I think is pretty cool. So John Hoffman, co-creator of Only Murders in the Building with Steve Martin, found an off-Broadway play that he performed in as a one-man show. And it took me 8 years, but I got it made with Diane Keaton starring. And I got John the supporting role that he wanted, that I, you know, this character Ratman, why he wanted to play Ratman, I don't know.
How did you do that? So you found the piece, I'm guessing you saw the performance.
Yeah, and then read the play, met with John and his director. They decided they wanted to write the script together. Mm-hmm. Our first meeting, they had never read a screenplay. I gave them 3 screenplays that I thought were quality and said, go read this and let's start meeting. And then, you know, it took a while. We, you know, attached various directors and couldn't get it made. And then finally, we did the show out here. And John got signed by William Morris. And then that's where Diane Keaton was at the time. And I remember going for my first meeting with Diane Keaton. And, you know, like, you shouldn't meet your heroes because, you know, it could be really disappointing. But I loved her and I still loved her. She just turned out to be a gem. So that was great. But I'll never forget this, because we had a meeting about the script and we talked about it. And at the end of it, she said, I want to be in the Nina Sadowski business. And I was like, I want to be in the Diane Keaton business.
Wow.
So that was really fun. So I'm really proud of John. I mean, it's just thrilling for me, you know, how well he's done. Another person who wrote his first script for me was Clark Gregg, who went on to write What Lies Beneath for Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer, but, you know, also went on to become part of the Marvel universe as Agent Coulson. So he was an actor at the Atlantic Theater Company, where I was on the advisory board. And he was like, I really want to direct. And I was like, well, then you should write something, because that would be the fastest route in to show that you had affinity for the material. And so he wrote a script for me called Fate, which was a good script. We didn't get made, but that became his writing sample that got him hired by DreamWorks, launched his whole career. So, you know, I love moments like that, you know, where I see that I saw something in someone and supported it, and then they sort of just, you know, blossom beyond my wildest dreams. It's so beautiful.
Yeah, and you found them early.
Yeah,
in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
through all of these points, whether it's, you know, being a quote unquote starstruck by someone that you wanted to work with, a director, getting the green light on projects when you're first starting out, mm-hmm. what would you say is the most visceral moment where you thought, oh, you know, this is going to work out for me?
Well, I still don't know if it's going to work out for me. I feel still feel like it's a...
I'll be your horoscope here, Nina. I think it's going to work out.
I don't think it's like it's still an evolutionary thing happening. I still think it's working out, right? And I actually, that's a great question, but I really feel like working in this business and working at, or in any business as an artist, is about constant reinvention.
Of course.
Right? You reinvent yourself for the times, for the project, for what you're experiencing. You know, because I don't really believe that there's separation of the personal and the art, even if people are, you know, masking it, right? Like it has to influence, your life has to influence what you're creating. I don't, you know, could not. But I feel like there's so much, you know, I'm still figuring it out. But I think that's not a bad thing, right? Because I feel like this capacity for reinvention is actually a great skill, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I think like when the last recession happened and, you know, which was a terrible time for me because I had, you know, the trifecta of divorce where I was paying alimony and then the writer's strike and then the depression.
Yeah.
So that's probably the period where I reinvented myself the most because I was someone who was, you know, comfortably supporting a family of four, you know, with a six-figure income for a long time. And then suddenly I was supporting two households because I was supporting my ex and sole support of the kids. And I couldn't work because I had stepped out of producing and or executive roles. So no one would hire me there. And I was a Writers Guild writer, so I couldn't write. And, you know, I remember like walking around the picket sign and people coming up to me and going, what are you doing here? I remember pitching to you. He's like the smartest exec I ever pitched to. And I was like, well, thank you, but I'm on the other side now, right? But then, you know, so it's like been every step of the way has been reinvention. And usually it's come from me feeling like I'm stuck, like I'm banging at some door, you know, that is not opening. And me deciding, all right, well, rather than stand here and bang on this door, I'm going to go bang. I'm going to open another door. And just see what else I could do. And so it hasn't been like this plotted progression. It's been me feeling frustrated or getting fired or having a company collapse or something bad happening and having to pick myself up and go, okay, what am I going to do next? And having to bet on myself every time. And I think that's one of the things that I've, you know, really found is I'm really resilient and I let myself go down, but then I pick myself up and I just start going back to work. You know, we were talking about this a little bit before, you know, a producer, you create work if you don't have it, right? Because you can't not be busy, right? So I'm always creating work, you know.
What informed your intuition in deciding when it was time to stop banging on one door and then also what door to seek next?
Again, I wish I had more articulate answers about this. It was usually like a lot of weeping and then going, all right, well, clearly this is not working. I need to do something else. I mean, I did go through a very long stretch where I felt like I could only succeed sort of minimally, right? Like I felt very frustrated for a long time. I was not succeeding at the level of ambition that I wanted to. And I still don't know that I've fully succeeded at the level of ambition that I want to.
Will you ever feel that way though, no matter what you possibly achieve?
Probably not. I should probably take that up with my therapist. I did have a therapist once say to me, how many movies would it take for you to feel like you're a success? And I don't remember how many I had done at that time, like four something. And I was like, I don't know, but more than this. This is not, there's no answer. That's the wrong answer, you know. So I accept that. But I have a funny ambivalence about my ambition because on the one hand, it's what drives me and I am proud to be driven and I create and accomplish a lot and I, you know, do put a lot of good energy in the world and that's great. On the other hand, it's, you know, it's a little bitch that keeps you,
you know. Just like the first year.
Yeah, exactly.
In regards to writing that first book and when you were creating your own work, you mentioned that you didn't tell anyone about it for a year and a half because you didn't want to be questioned about it. How did you maintain the discipline to keep working on it consistently?
I made a promise to myself, and this when I teach writing, this is one of the biggest pieces of advice I give, is you have to show up for yourself. So I decided that I was going to write every Sunday for 3 or 4 hours, no matter what else was going on. And, you know, I declined brunch invitations. And, you know, no matter where I was on Sunday, I would write. It was aided by the fact that my stepson, my angry stepson, who had been awful to my son, they began to bond a little over football. So they could be in the same room. Now, I'm not least bit interested in football, but I could be in another room working on my book with an ear open to make sure no one was getting beaten up. And
perfect.
So it worked out perfect. Oh, but you know, there was something you asked about before about how, whether I was surprised when it sold. And I just wanted to mention this, that one of the things I did with that book was I completely blew up structure. It's told in completely nonlinear ways. There are alternating chapters entitled Now and Then. They are nonlinear. And part of that was just me rebelling against the very strict codification of structure rules for film and TV. That's why I think I was so shocked when it sold, because I just threw everything I knew about structure out the window, because I thought, who cares? No one's ever going to see this. This is just me working out my stuff, you know.
But you probably, I mean, it's kind of the thing where you have to know the rules to break them, right? So True. You were able to craft it in such a way where it still made sense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It still made sense, I think. I worked very hard. You know, like if you look behind you here, you'll see those index cards. That's my new book.
We're currently in Nina's beautiful office in Los Angeles.
And so there are a lot of color-coded index cards taped up onto my wall, which is the structure of my new book with little cryptic comments on them that allow me to look at the whole book in one visual.
Yeah.
There's a lot of index carding that goes on in this house.
Yeah. Are there other ways that you feel your living space informs your creativity or helps your creativity? And how has that changed moving from New York to Los Angeles?
Oh, well, you know, I lived in tiny apartments in New York and now I live in a spacious house. But I will say that the office in where now is the most beautiful workspace I've ever had. In the last house we lived, we crammed our four teenagers into a house. And so my office was a converted section of the garage that had no windows. You know, a lot of creative stuff happened in there regardless, but that was my office for a long time. And when my husband and I moved last year into this house, I got a really nice office, spacious, decorated.
Yeah, can confirm. It's a beautiful, beautiful space.
Colorful, nice vibe. So yeah, that was a big step up.
Okay, so now I just want to get into some general advice for the listeners. I know we touched on the strike last time and your experience with that. What is your advice to writers or other people in unions? Even non-union people are going to be affected by the strike. It's already affecting everyone. What's your advice?
It's already affecting everyone. I would say this, have realistic expectations, right? I think that I support unions. There are legitimate things to strike for. I think that you know, a lot of division I know about what are the important factors, but I also feel like a strike will inevitably hurt people. What I would say to writers is keep writing, because no one has to give you permission. And even if you're not getting paid, come out of the strike with a new piece of content, can't hurt you. You know, for people looking to break in, I would say it's probably a tough time. You know, writers' rooms aren't going to be staffing. You know, I think there's going to be a bit of a pall on the industry generally as people figure out how long it's going to last and what the consequences are going to be. But, you know, the advantage of having lived through one is, you know, that it ends and you know that things return. You know, I've been saying this about a lot of things. I think a lot of things in our culture are broken right now. And I think that all of us should be thinking about how to innovate, not how to fix everything, because why fix the things that are broken, but how to redo things. I think one thing that we learned, not out of the last strike, but out of the last guild action, where writers, including myself, left their agents over the TV packaging issue, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone was like, well, how are TV shows going to staff without agents, right? And TV shows staff just fine. Some of them had to hire outside readers to weed through submissions, but in TV, writers hire other writers. The agents were less necessary. And that's why I think that was a big disruption. I think, you know, agents generally are information brokers. And as we become into a more information permeable age, again, less necessary, you know. Before everything could be posted online, you know, if you were a busy studio head, you wanted your buddy at the agency to say, these are the 10 best writers we have, right? Now it's much more permeable. I think that's good. It gives a lot more access to people. So it's removing a lot of gatekeepers, which I think is healthy.
Yeah.
So I think that'll be good. And I think that we need to keep thinking about that. You know, how do we, you know, disrupt things so that we can protect you know, creatives, particularly with what's happening with AI, which is a whole other.
Oh my gosh.
Whole other subject, terrifying subject. But, you know, I think it's important that we recognize that it's important to stand strong and recognize that things will be weathered, but don't have unrealistic expectations. This is not the time to think you're going to get signed by an agent. It's not the time to think that you're going to, you know, get into a writer's room. There'll be some production probably because they will say that scripts are locked, although everyone knows a script is never really locked. So that's a fiction. But, you know, I felt I was very adversely affected by the last strike. That was very much about where I was in my life and my career. I know a lot of people, other people who are adversely affected, and a lot of people who, you know, killed it. My friend Alexi, who was the one who said, you know, we're writers, get nosed 10 times before breakfast. Yeah, you know, he went on to create The Rookie and, you know, its spinoffs. I mean, he's a huge network, you know, TV showrunner now, you know.
Yeah.
Couldn't happen to a better, nicer person, right? So he didn't affect him permanently. But I know there were people who didn't ever really recover. Mm-hmm. And so, but you know, that, I mean, listen, this is a capricious business. This business is an ugly mistress. And I say, you know, you were in my classes. I say, if there's something else you can do, go do it, because this business will beat you up. But if you feel like this is what you need to do, like you have to be a storyteller, which I feel, right? This is why I can empathize with that. If you feel that, then you have to go pursue that, and you should pursue that. There's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't. You have to stay true to your authentic self, stay true to your goals, even if you don't know what your steps are along the way, be willing to revisit your goals and adapt them, and keep faith in yourself and build community, right? And I think that even through a difficult period in a strike, you can work on those principles. How am I advancing my knowledge? How am I advancing my connections? How am I advancing my understanding of where I'd like to go? Those are all things that can happen internally, even if the business is, you know, sort of slow down or...
Totally. Do you think there are any lessons from the pandemic that would apply to weathering this in terms of resilience and things getting shut down?
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like all of our resilience muscles are pretty tested right now. So I feel like dealing with a strike or anything else stressful is harder for everyone. I just think that's true. I have a lot of compassion for all of us as a race, because I feel like it's been so brutal the last few years. But I do think, you know, the one good thing about having your resilience muscle tested is that it does get stronger. And I think that, you know, I mean, I found like I've always been a person who's, well, not always, but in my more recent years, a pretty good about self-care. So I have a lot of modalities, breath work, you know, exercise, you know, nature walks. Like I do all the things, right? You know, journaling. I do all the things that you're supposed to do. I found they became less utile for me as time went on. They provide less release.
Really?
But writing gave me the most, right? Mm-hmm. Like all those things which were supposedly about putting things into me did not help me feel as good as something that was, you know, taking something out of me or releasing something out of me. So, you know, I've always believed bet on yourself, right? I've always, it's something I've preached to people I've mentored, to any student I've had. You know, you are the one unique thing, right? Every person has their own unique voice, their own set of experiences and worldviews that contribute to how they approach things. And, you know, just keep, you know, as a creator, hone in on that. And if you're a producer or someone else who's, you know, developing other people's creativity, also look for that, right? Because that kind of authenticity is what really drives things. When I was a producer and I was reading 20 scripts a week, right, I could always tell whether someone was like chasing a trend or had thought, oh, that sounds commercial, right? Like you could just tell in the writing, and then, you know, you get something that came from a different place, a more heartfelt place, and you could feel that too. And I think, you know, I feel like the goal in making movies or writing books, right, it's pretty simple, right? With any piece of narrative fiction, and I only really work in fiction, not doc, but what you want to do is you want to create characters that a reader or an audience is going to feel empathy for. You want to put that character or characters in experiences that are going to give the audience anxiety about them. And then you want to resolve it in a way that gives catharsis, right? It's really that simple, right? Like that's like what I call math for writers. It's like, you know, empathy plus anxiety plus catharsis, you know, equals successful storytelling, right? Yeah. So math for writers is really the most simplistic thing. But how do you do that you cannot develop empathy, that first step, unless you have characters that people are going to care about. And so that's the hard work of being a creator, is creating characters that, you know, can do, even doing loathsome things, sometimes people still care about them.
Well, I mean, that's probably also kind of your spin on the right, what you know, advice, right, is writing about what you know in terms of emotion and when things get difficult, and transferring that to your characters so that people find them relatable.
Right. Well, I think that's true. It's like, I think that this is not my advice. This is advice from a very good writer named Maggie Stiefvater, but, you know, she, and was quoted to me, so I'm probably mangling it, but I'll take the general principle is, if you grew up on an Iowa corn farm, right, you can write about being on an Iowa corn farm, but you could also write about, you know, what that would mean about being reliant on a small group of family members and or a community and not having people close by. You could apply it, you know, to a space station or a boarding school, right? They're emotional. You should write what you know in terms of emotional truth.
Yeah.
And then feel free to research and extrapolate everything else, because otherwise, you know, it would be dull. We can't just write ourselves.
Yeah,
there?
And if you need immediate examples of how to do that, all five of Nina's current books are available on ninasadowska.com. Okay, I want to get into our time capsule segment to freeze this moment in time for you. So we'll go past, present, and then future. For the past, if you could write a letter to yourself 5 years ago, what would you include?
I would say you did all right. You survived a pandemic.
Oh, God.
You built a school program during a pandemic. You managed to publish 2 books during a pandemic and start a third. You have made some short films and done a lot, given it's been a hellish time on Earth. Mm-hmm. So I think if I wrote back to myself 5 years ago, I'd say, you know, hang in there. You're going to make it. Primarily.
Would you add anything to that if you were writing to yourself just graduating college with your dance degree?
Yeah, well, if I was writing to myself then, as which is at this point a much younger person, I think I would have, I would just probably echo something what I had said before, which is to carry less shame. Mm-hmm. And less shame and more ownership, more pride. Mm-hmm. To look at that balance of how I handle things in life.
Definitely. Okay, going to the present, what is your favorite song right now?
Oh, my favorite song? Oh, that's such a good question. Probably Don't Go Dark by The Dreamers.
Good pick. What is the best movie you've seen in the last year?
Oh, well, that's tough. But I love The Menu.
Wow. Yeah. Honestly, I mean, I don't know why I'm surprised, Nina. You love the dark stories.
I do. I do love a dark story. I don't know. I don't know that that was my favorite movie, although it's one that I just, now I'm going to not remember a single movie I've ever seen. Oh, you know what I saw, which was really interesting, though, was No Bears, which is a movie made by an imprisoned director about a director who he plays himself in Iran, and he's a director who's trying to direct a movie over the border to Turkey because he's been banned from leaving the country. So it's very meta, but it's about filmmaking and it's about oppression. And so I think that's probably the most recent movie that I saw that really stayed with me. You know, The Menu is like delicious. Set, dark, fun.
People listening to this who don't know Nina, the reason it's just, we're in this beautiful, sunny, bright, cheery office, and she's wearing this gorgeous bright blue shawl, and her note cards are pastel, and yeah, but she just has a taste.
Well, that's my whole brand. You know, my dispatch is the dispatch from the cheerfully dark mind of Nina Sadowski. And I maintain that I am such a cheerful person because I get all my dark stuff out on the page. And that's how I, you know, no one wakes up with a knife in their stomach like my husband. So that's the whole secret.
What is the best book that you've read within the last year?
Well, I really loved We Keep the Dead Close, which is a sort of a true crime investigation, which I reads like a novel and really sort of blows the lid off of Ivy League pretentiousness. And then I'm reading now Pineapple Street, which is a delightful sort of skewering of, you know, the wealthy in Brooklyn, sort of entertaining. And I'm about to start The Coddling of the American Mind, which I'm excited to read.
Just hitting all your bases.
Yes, I'm covering all my bases. Yes.
What restaurant or coffee shop are you currently obsessed with?
Oh, well, too many. That's a problem. I mean, is. I'm a foodie and I really like a lot of restaurants. I just came back from a trip to New York where I basically ate my way through a swath of fantastic new places. I tried Georgian food, which I'd never had before. I got a place called Chama Mama. I went to a sushi bar that was like a speakeasy hidden in the basement of a Korean fried chicken joint. I just had a swath. But in LA, I love Birdie G's. That's a perennial favorite. And I don't know why there's so many restaurants. It's just terrifying.
Is there anything by work that you took me to a really good donut place the last time I saw you?
Oh, yeah. I am obsessed with Sidecar Donuts, which unfortunately moved next door to my office. That was really rude of them because I smell them every morning when I drive in. It's just like Pied Piper time. But yeah, so yeah, well, near my office, my office is right near the farmer's market. So there are a ton of good places there. There's Monsieur Marcel, which is a great little French place. There, you know, Micheline, which is a countertop bakery that makes the best BLT I've ever had.
Well, all the good recommendations. You've been teaching for a while at several institutions. What's the biggest change you've seen in your students and young filmmakers in 2023?
Well, you know, I've been teaching, for a while. And I would say that what I'm seeing this semester, thankfully, is sort of a settling down after what I felt was a lot of high anxiety and mental health issues, which I didn't blame anyone for. God knows, I feel like we all are, you know, collectively dealing with this. But I think, you know, it's interesting because I would say that every class or every semester that I've ever taught has had sort of a different character to it. The students are different. The vibe is different. Sometimes you get a semester full of like sweet angels. Sometimes you get a semester with one person that completely hijacks everything. So, I mean, I think that's part of what keeps it interesting. It's sort of like movie making is interesting, right? You're doing the same thing roughly, but with a different crew, different parameters, different people, different money, different locations. Same thing with running a school program, because my program now is a study away program, where when I was teaching, I would teach, you know, different group every semester. It was always very much defined by the students, you know, what that experience was. So I think that, but I think people are beginning to calm down a little bit, which I think is healthy. And I also, but I would say that what I've seen in the last few years, which has really impressed me, is how many students, even when they're students, have such a strong entrepreneurial spirit that they're just going out and making stuff and doing things and, you know, getting things made. And one of the things I'm really excited about is I'm in the last stages of closing kind of a grant that's going to give marketing money and advice to students who have finished projects, so that the students who are showing that kind of initiative, and whether they're making, you know, a film, a short film, or even a feature, or whether they're creating an EP or a Spotify channel, this grant will allow them to get money to market what they've created, as well as some advice on how to do it. Because that's the thing that I've seen that really impresses me. Everyone's got a side hustle. Everyone's working, you know, it's students who are competing in beatbox competitions, making music videos. We have a current student who's a finalist on The Voice China.
Oh my gosh, wow. Yeah.
You know, it's just like, and so I feel like, you know, this is what they're doing while they're undergrads. Let's try to find a way to boost that and support that. I'm kind of excited.
Yeah, that's great. Because I know there's a lot of talk about how people lose faith in themselves shortly after graduating. And
it's very hard. I think that first year at a, you know, even the first 2 years, I think it's harder now because of the pandemic too, and just the sort of the general economy. But I think those first couple of years out of college, you know, for particularly for a lot of students for whom it was never a question that they were going to go to college, right? Right. For a lot of people who were like, that was their family goal, whether they were first gen or, you know, Mayflower, right? They knew that that was their goal. And so from, you know, all of their childhood through high school, then they were finally in the college, right? And then they graduate and suddenly the roadmap is gone. And, you know, you don't have the support and you don't have the direction. And that's the thing you've been striving for your whole life. And now what? And so I think there's a time of personal discovery, but I think there's also a real challenge right now because of the societal changes that are happening.
Definitely. Well, it sounds like you have the perfect students to rise to that challenge if they're entrepreneurial, and then that fits perfectly with your advice of betting on yourself and carving your own path. So
yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, I don't think anyone can work in any of the interrelated entertainment industries and not, in a sense, be their own producer.
It's so true. Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah.
What are your current interests or hobbies? I am definitely going to ask you to speak about your collage work.
Okay, I do a lot of collage work. So I collect ephemera from trips or from experiences, the things that you would normally throw out, like train tickets, brochures, admission passes, and I recreate them into collage. I started doing it because I would come home from trips with all this junk and it would sit in a drawer and I would occasionally look at it. And so I started making them. So there are a few here and there are a bunch in my office as well. So I do make art as a hobby. I'm very obsessed with Pilates, which is, I don't know if that's a hobby or an obsession. And swimming. I'm very into the things that keep me physically, that I also find meditative, right? And another thing I'm currently obsessed with is poker face. So love Ryan Johnson, love Natasha Lyonne. Didn't have Peacock, finally broke down to get it for Poker Face and then like binged it in 3 days. And I think that, you know, it's very much a reference to 70s television, which is also entertaining. It's basically Columbo. Do you know this? She's basically playing Columbo, which is a 70s cop show. And I, at the advice of a friend who had said, you have to watch Poker Face. I know you're going to love it. And then he said, and then watch the pilot of Columbo. And I did, and I saw his comparison. Then I realized that Stephen Bochco wrote the pilot of Columbo, and Steven Spielberg directed the pilot of Columbo, which was just sort of mind-blowing from a history of television and film perspective.
Definitely.
Anyway, so I don't know, I do love television. I love watching TV. I love making art. I love getting out in the world. I like to cook. I don't do it enough, but I do like to cook.
Yeah, those are well-rounded. I'm definitely going to take some photos of these collage works and post them on the Instagram so people can see what we're talking about. The cheerfully part of the cheerfully dark mind. Okay, getting to the future section. Okay, 5 years from now, and you probably have the most realistic answer of anyone I've spoken to about this. Where do you imagine you will be living?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. Maybe right here. I don't know, since we just moved into this house.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I'm a native New Yorker who's really come to love L.A., but neither of my kids live here anymore. One lives in Portland and one lives in New York. So that's problematic. Don't like being apart from them. But yeah, I don't know. I think 5 years, I'll probably still be here in L.A., probably still running NYU L.A. and growing it. So
yeah. In 5 years, is there anything you hope will have been invented?
Oh, yes. Anything that can help reverse climate change.
Mm.
That, to me, is probably the most pressing issue we're dealing with. It's, you know, it's real. It's existential. It's terrifying. I know there's a lot of good work. I have a colleague who's doing work on carbon removal systems that remove carbon from the air and can convert it into building material.
Oh, that's amazing.
I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. Everyone should attend the Hollywood Climate Summit in June. June 21st through 24th and learn.
Where could they find information if they wanted to attend?
HollywoodClimateSummit.com. This will be the fourth year. That's something I'm very proud of in my capacity at NYU. We sponsored the first Hollywood Climate Summit and the second one in conjunction with Netflix. And now they have so many sponsors, they don't need us anymore. But it's a great event and a really important and useful way to learn about how all of us can make a difference and reverse climate change. So my invention would be anything that will do that. I want all of us to have a planet to live on. As I say all the time, no planet, no production. So
you're not wrong.
Simple. Right. So
okay, the year is 2028. How many books have you written total?
Well, I like to knock out one a year. So it's 23 now. So
10?
Yeah, it would be 10.
The year is 2028. What do you think is the subject line of your first e-dispatch, your newsletter?
What year is it?
2028. So 5 years from now.
5 years from now. The subject line. Okay. I'm going to say, here I am, up for more trouble.
The year is 2028. What social issue do you think is being skewered in a dark comedy?
That's a great question. Well, I think we'll have moved off by the rich by then. So, you know what I would love, which was just being skewered, is just the polarization. Right? The extremism on either sides of the political discourse. Because I feel like, you know, as I said before, I believe we're much more alike than we are different. I believe it's extreme loudmouths on both sides that are creating a lot of the divisiveness. And if we could skewer that in a way that made that point to people, Like, I was at a conference, I heard this amazing statistic that 14%, so 7% of the left and 7% of the right, control 86% of social media discourse online.
I totally believe that, yeah.
So it's the loudmouths on both sides who are creating a lot, I think, a lot of tension, a lot of anger, a lot of hatred. And so let's skewer that and show how silly that is, that we're letting such a few radical people on both sides
represent everyone. Yeah.
Represent everybody. Yeah.
Nina, well, where can people keep up with you online?
I am at ninasadowski.com. And on there, there is a sign up for my dispatch, the aforementioned Tearfully Dark Dispatches from the Mind of Nina Sadowski. So that's another way. And also on Instagram.
At?
Nina_Sadowski.
That's NINA_SADOWSKY.
Also there, you will find on promote my books and stuff, but I will also talk about some of the events that we do in conjunction with NYU Los Angeles. Like last night, we hosted a climate comedy event to help bring awareness to sustainability issues. And we intend to do more things like that, that are open to the community.
Awesome. Perfect. So was the Hollywood Climate Summit and the event last night, are they related? Are there any specific organizations you want to plug?
Yeah. So Yeah Impact, which is founded by Allison Bagelman, is, I think, a brilliant social impact organization affiliated with Young Entertainment Activists, which is a large group of young people in the industry, but a great group of people and a great group of people to network with. Also, the Good Energy Playbook was involved in last night's event, and that's an open source tool for people who want to imbue their work with sustainability issues. In my new book, I actually have a character who's a climate documentarian, and I'm using Good Energy Playbook to help do things for her character. And also, Generation 180 was our other partner last night. These are all organizations that are working in the climate space.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for your time today, for giving us insight on the strike into your own journey and providing some cheerfully dark optimism for the years ahead.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here is a recap of some takeaways from my conversation with Nina. 1, you don't always have to know exactly what you're doing at each step in your career. Take a shot, be willing to be humbled, and learn from your mistakes. 2, your identity is not the company you work for or the project you made, and you don't need to own shame when a film or job doesn't work out. 3, career building is community building. 4, if you spent your career championing others, reflect on when it may be time to discover your own voice. 5, being an artist means constantly reinventing yourself by adapting. 6, if you're banging at a door that's not opening, it may be time to open another door. 7, you have to show up for yourself. 8, have realistic expectations. And 9, keep writing. No one has to give you permission. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of No Set Path. If you enjoyed this episode, please feel free to rate it and share it with a friend, especially if you can think of someone who might benefit from the knowledge that was shared here today. You can keep up with the podcast on all social platforms at No Set Path Show or on the website at www.nosetpathshow.com. Thanks so much for being part of this community, and we'll talk to you soon.